Hello and welcome to this election 2019 special installment of the 538 Politics podcast. I'm Galen Druk. The results are mostly in and Democrats had a pretty good night. At the time of recording Wednesday morning, Kentucky's gubernatorial race is still too close to call, according to the Associated Press. But Democrat Andy Beshear is leading incumbent Republican Governor Matt Bevin there by half a point with all precincts reporting. In Virginia, Democrats flipped both the state House and Senate, giving them full party control of state government there since they already have the governorship. And then in Mississippi, Republicans will keep the governor's seat with a 7-point win over the Democrat. There's lots more to get into as well. We're going to talk about the national environment, local versus Washington politics, and whether this gives us any hints about 2020. And here with me to do that are two 538 elections analysts, Jeffrey Skelly and Nathaniel Rakich. Hello, Jeff and Nathaniel. Thank you for joining me this morning.
Hey, Galen. How was your birthday?
It was good. Thanks for mentioning that. I was not up all night watching returns, although after dinner I did start tuning in. Thanks to you guys for staying up all night and crunching the returns so that you could be here with me this morning to talk about it.
Yeah, no problem.
Let's begin with the big picture. Jeffrey, what is your top line takeaway from the night?
I think my top line takeaway is that national forces outweigh state forces and that we sort of saw this in the suburbs. Now, it's not cut and dry on that because obviously the Kentucky result would seem to run against what we know about national conditions. But I would argue that that was a special case because actually Republicans swept, sometimes by very large margins, the rest of the statewide offices in Kentucky. So Matt Bevin was a particularly special case. But you saw actually in other elections outside of Kentucky and Virginia, in Mississippi, you saw Democrats do well in the suburbs of Philadelphia, for example, in some local elections, the big collar counties there. So I think it's state forces are still important to some extent, but we really saw national forces at work, and they really showed themselves in the suburbs because that's also where the Democrats made most of their, you know, pretty much almost all their gains in Virginia.
Yeah, Nathaniel, considering that what seems to be getting the headlines this morning is that Kentucky race, do you think it's fair to say that the national environment is trumping state-level politics in the 2019 elections?
Yeah, I think it's just more of what we already thought that we knew, which is that politics is increasingly national, but there is still some wiggle room around the edges for candidate quality to make a difference, for, you know, local considerations to make a difference. And like Jeffrey said, I think you saw that in Kentucky. You know, it was still, you know, Matt Bevin is literally the least popular governor in the country, and he still came within half a percentage point of winning, and that's due to partisanship, frankly. So the variation between that race and, say, the state attorney general race is because, I think, of Bevin's unpopularity. But overall, I think the results were good for Democrats. They didn't show some huge unexpected Democratic tsunami, but they continued to outperform the partisanship of their states and districts in a way that is consistent with a fairly blue environment.
Yeah, so let's get into that, Nathaniel. In 2018, Democrats won the House popular vote by 8.5 points. That was a very blue national environment. We called it a blue wave. What was the national environment like on Tuesday, numerically?
So I have preliminarily crunched the numbers for Virginia, at least, and basically what the district-by-district numbers there look like when you compare to 538's partisan lean is that in the state Senate, Democrats outperformed their partisan lean by 4 points on average, and in the House of Delegates, they outperformed it by 3 points on average. Now, if you compare that to special elections that have happened so far this year, Democrats have outperformed by 5 points on average, and in the 2018 cycle, they overperformed partisan lean in special elections by 10 points on average. But it's important to remember that there are incumbents in these Virginia elections, whereas special elections are pretty much always open seat races. So if you look only at the open seat races in Virginia, Democrats actually outperformed partisan lean by 9 points. So it was actually a pretty strong performance by them. Basically, this performance reminded me a lot of 2017.
Looking at the congressional generic ballot right now on 538.com, I see that Democrats are leading by about 5.5 points or so. Is it fair to say that the overall national environment is less blue than it was in 2018?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we've talked about this before, Galen, and that does seem to be the consensus of the indicator. Special elections have been a little bit less good for Democrats this year. The generic ballot is a little bit less good. But I will say, I think that these results for Democrats last night were very impressive and maybe more on par with a 2018 level environment. That said, you know, you can argue that maybe Virginia isn't very representative. It's a particularly anti-Trump state. So that might have something to do with it. So we'll see. I think on balance, the smart money is that it's a slightly less blue environment than 2018, but still blue.
Jeffrey, what kinds of overall trends are we seeing in terms of how Democrats and Republicans are performing in rural, suburban, and urban areas last night?
Sure. Well, at least in Virginia's state legislative elections, all the Democratic pickups came in suburban or exurban or a little urban seats. You didn't see Democrats making any didn't see them making much headway in rural areas, though there was actually a Southwest Virginia district where the Democrat way outperformed Hillary Clinton, but still lost very badly. That's basically the most Republican part of the state. And in Kentucky, you know, the down ticket Republican statewide candidates all performed much better than Matt Bevin, obviously, because they won.
By how much? Is it something like 20 points? Is that what I saw?
It varies. I mean, Bevin lost by about a half point based on what we have right now in the attorney general's race, which was an open seat because Andy Beshear, who won the governor's race, was the sitting attorney general. The Republican won by 15, 16 points or so. So, you know, it was sort of that kind of comparison in terms of the open seats to the governor's race. But anyway, like Bevin's performance, where you really saw him struggle, was actually in places like the Cincinnati suburbs. Real huge shifts toward Andy Beshear compared to the 2015 gubernatorial election, where Bevin did much better in some of those counties that are just south of the Ohio River outside of Cincinnati. And so I think the suburbs were a real warning sign for the GOP, and we saw that in the 2018 election. The Democratic gains almost entirely in the House almost entirely came from suburban and exurban areas of the country. So that, I think, has got to be the top concern for the GOP going forward. At the same time, though, I don't want to overstate the point because, as I said, some of those down-ballot Republicans in Kentucky, for instance, did fine or comparatively much better than Bevin in those types of counties. So it may just sort of depend race to race on the candidate. And it, I guess the question is, you know, Matt Bevin has tried to mimic Donald Trump in some ways, but is Trump's appeal different from Bevin's at the end of the day? And I would argue probably. So, I'm always a little hesitant to sort of oversell just what this might mean for 2020. But at the end of the day, I do think the suburbs were a real big story here.
Nathaniel, does that track for you? I mean, were there any places where rural or urban areas did something unexpected, or is the real story here like the rural and urban areas stayed exactly as we expected them to be and the movement is in the suburbs?
No, I mean, I think that urban and suburban areas are getting more Democratic and rural areas on balance are getting more Republican. There was some kind of variation in Kentucky because Beshear showed some strength in some of the old coal mining counties in eastern Kentucky. But yeah, just to echo Jeffrey's point, so Beshear got 47% in the three counties in the Cincinnati suburbs that Jeffrey mentioned. And in 2015, the Democratic candidate for governor got only 37% there. You saw a similar thing happen in Mississippi. So for example, Madison County is the wealthiest county in Mississippi. It's the Jackson suburbs. And Jim Hood, the Democratic nominee there, when he ran for attorney general in 2015, winning the state handily, he lost Madison County. But this year, he won Madison County, even though he was doing significantly worse and losing statewide.
So what does this tell us broadly? I know, Jeffrey, you were sensitive to saying that this gives us hints about what's to come in 2020. But if the suburbs continue this leftward shift, essentially, what does that mean for Republican and Democratic politics looking forward?
Well, I guess that thinking about what Democrats did in 2018 and where they won their House seats and the kinds of candidates who tended to win those seats were comparatively moderate compared to, you know, the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes of the world. And so, I mean, I think one of the big stories of the House Democratic Caucus was the growth of sort of the center center-left part of that party. And so, and I think the suburbs are a key part of that because, you know, it looks like things like Medicare for All don't necessarily poll terribly well in a lot of suburbs. And so it makes me wonder about sort of the positioning for presidential candidates in 2020 in the Democratic primary. So that's one aspect of it that I do think about. And I wonder if Democrats nominate someone who is pretty left-wing, you know, can they hold up these sorts of gains that they seem to be have made? And I guess it's an open question. But at the same time, is Donald Trump unpopular enough in the suburbs that maybe that doesn't matter as much as we might think it does? Because if everything's about Trump and he's not that popular in those parts of the country, maybe it doesn't matter that much at the end of the day.
You know, when it comes to this potentially being about Trump in the suburbs, one thing that's changed since the last time Americans went to the polls is Democrats started their impeachment inquiry. Is it appropriate to see any of the results from Tuesday night as a referendum on Democrats' impeachment push?
I think that it is fair to say that impeachment didn't help Bevin. It didn't kind of rally up the Republican base the way that he wanted it to. He obviously held a rally with Trump. He, you know, ran ads that focused on impeachment, and it didn't work, obviously. It's hard to say whether it worked in the reverse, where Democrats were particularly riled up, because, again, Bevin himself was so unpopular, it's hard to separate that out.
What was turnout overall like, looking at the various states where we had either statewide or state legislative races?
Well, it's a little complicated in Virginia because it's not like every single House of Delegates race or state senate race was contested by both parties. So that makes it a little tougher to just add up all the numbers there. But it was pretty clear that turnout was high in Virginia. And looking at the statewide races, the gubernatorial contests in Kentucky and Mississippi, turnout was way up in Kentucky from the 2015 gubernatorial election. So I was doing a little number crunching on this using data from Michael McDonald, who runs Elect Project. And 43%, based on my estimate, of the voting eligible population, so anyone over 18 who's a citizen who could register to vote, 43% turned out in the Kentucky gubernatorial race. Now, that might sound low, but only 30% showed up in 2015. So obviously that's a very large increase. You know, the total number of votes went from almost 1 million to nearly 1.5 million. So very substantial. And in Mississippi, it was up to 37% from 33% of the voting eligible population. And, you know, in Virginia, those elections are usually very low turnout in this particular cycle. It's basically like the gubernatorial midterm election in Virginia. But turnout was definitely up across the state in most legislative districts.
It's also worth noting that those turnout numbers were even higher than they were in the 2014 midterm elections for both Mississippi and Kentucky. Now, obviously, midterms are lower turnout than presidentials, but for an odd year to be higher than an even year is kind of significant.
And what kinds of people were turning out to vote? Are we able to tell whether there's an enthusiasm gap between Democrats and Republicans from the turnout last night?
It's tougher to say, but I mean, I guess given the results and the lean that Nathaniel was finding when he was looking through the data in terms of how Democrats were compared to past elections, I would think that there was at least, especially with a relatively unpopular president, a Republican president in the White House, that Democrats had some advantage in terms of turnout. How much is, I think, difficult to say. And, you know, I think there is a thought that higher turnout is usually good for Democrats, but that is not necessarily true in all cases, or even in a lot of cases. Because think about Kentucky. It's a Republican-leaning state. If you have high turnout there, a lot of the people who might be sort of more marginal voters or less likely to show up are probably Republican-leaning. So maybe it's even more impressive that Beshear seems to have pulled out a narrow win in a high turnout environment in Kentucky.
Yeah, I mean, something that's worth noting about Kentucky is we've talked plenty about non-college educated white voters, and Kentucky is 87% white, with 20-some percent of the population having a college degree. And it seems like the polls there were pretty accurate. So does that tell us something about this conversation we've been having about how well the polls are doing at picking up the white working class vote?
No, I mean, there were only, I believe, two bowls of Kentucky in the entire stretch run, and one of them actually was quite off because it showed Bashir winning by a huge margin, so I'm not sure that we really learned anything about the accuracy of polls from these elections. I mean, we know that polls were quite accurate in 2018, as Nate recently wrote for the site, but yeah, they're actually the lack of polling for these 2019 races was a huge problem. The presidential race, I think, is sucking up a lot of the oxygen there.
Yeah, I mean, it is true that the other poll that we had from Kentucky, the one that I think most people pointed to and saw as indicative of the environment everyone sort of expected for the race, you know, to be very close, was a Mason-Dixon poll that had it tied at 46 all in Kentucky. And, you know, in that case, you would say, yeah, did a pretty good job. But there was this other poll that was markedly off. So it's, you know, you can sort of pick and choose and say, well, that seemed close. But as a whole, it's kind of difficult to say because, as Nathaniel said, there wasn't much polling to go on.
All right. So I want to take a look at some of the specifics in the states that we've talked about and maybe expand out to referenda and other local races around the country. But before we do that, today's podcast is brought to you by Bespoke Post. This fall, start a new monthly routine that'll upgrade your life and style with a box of awesome from Bespoke Post. Bespoke Post sends guys only the best stuff every month, so whether you're looking to craft your own hard cider or toast perfectly aged fall cocktails, Box of Awesome has you covered. From style and grooming goods to barware, cooking tools, and outdoor gear, Box of Awesome has carefully built collections for every part of your life. To get started, take the quiz at boxofawesome.com. Your answers will help you pick the right Box of Awesome for you. They release new boxes every month across a ton of different categories. It's free to sign up, and you can skip a month or cancel any time. Each box costs only $45, but has over $70 worth of gear inside. Get 20% off your first monthly box when you sign up at boxofawesome.com and enter the code POLITICS at checkout. That's boxofawesome.com, code POLITICS, for 20% off your first box. Today's podcast is also brought to you by Lightstream. The holidays are approaching, and you may be thinking about how you're going to save some extra money. Well, here's a way that maybe you haven't thought of. Consolidate your high-interest credit card balances with a lower rate and save with Lightstream. Get a rate as low as 5.95% APR with AutoPay, which is much lower than the national average interest rate of over 20% APR. Plus, your rate is fixed, so as rates rise, your low rate won't budge. There are no fees, and you can even get your money as soon as the day you apply. Just for listeners, apply now to get a special interest rate discount. The only way to get this discount is to go to lightstream.com/538. That's lightstream.com/538. And that's subject to credit approval. Rate includes 0.5% auto pay discount. Terms and conditions apply, and offers are subject to change without notice. Visit lightstream.com/538 for more information. All right, we're back. And before we broaden out to kind of other dispersed local races and referenda, I want to zoom in on a few things within the three states that we've already discussed. So Kentucky, Mississippi, and Virginia. Let's just get this kind of out of the way right now. We saw in the governor's race in Kentucky a Democrat likely to win by half a point. Does that mean that Kentucky is going to be competitive in 2020?
No.
Nathaniel, concur?
I concur.
All right. And do we need to expand on that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, look, I did see some people sort of in the, you know, as things were closing out and it looked like Bashir was going to hold on to this real narrow lead in the gubernatorial race for the Democrats. I saw some people on Twitter talking about, oh, Mitch McConnell, he might really be in danger in 2020. It's just unlikely. Look, Matt Bevin was a particularly unpopular governor. And there's more of a separation between a gubernatorial race and sort of the national, like federal conditions, than there is between a presidential race and a Senate race on the ballot at the same time, which is what is going to happen in 2020. And I just have a very difficult time imagining a circumstance where Donald Trump is winning Kentucky by, you know, a really big margin and Mitch McConnell is not also winning. Now, it's very possible that McConnell will not win by nearly as large a margin as President Trump, because McConnell is also pretty unpopular, has a very poor approval rating. But I just think people should really hold their horses and maybe even look down ballot at the other statewide races in Kentucky to see really more of what the environment is for Democrats in Kentucky as a general rule.
We saw a decent amount of split ticket voting in Kentucky, as is apparent from the difference in vote totals for the governor's race versus AG and on down the ballot. Generally, I think consumers of political news know that split ticket voting is on the decline. Does Kentucky's results kind of change our thinking about that at all, or is it only in very peculiar cases where this happens?
No, I mean, look, it's just one data point, and you know, we had some of these data points in 2018 as well. So, for example, Charlie Baker is a Republican governor in my home state of Massachusetts, which also voted for Elizabeth Warren at the same time in 2018. So, you know, no, every so often you're going to have a politician who breaks the mold because they have cross-party appeal or because they're extraordinarily unpopular. But overall, the trend is clear that the correlation of partisanship and results is becoming stronger and stronger.
Are there lessons in Matt Bevin's poor showing for other politicians? Like, why was he so unpopular?
It's an interesting question in the sense that, you know, Matt Bevin actually has done certain things, has sort of been abrasive and has fought with people in Kentucky, the media, his own party. And it reminds you a little bit of President Trump. But I do think Bevin's ability to alienate even a lot of people in his own party, as seen by the fact that he actually only won 52% in his primary back in May, which is very bad for an incumbent governor running for renomination, is indicative of the fact that whereas President Trump does behave that way sometimes, Republicans are unified behind him. And you could pretty clearly say that was not the case in Kentucky. So I think that's a key difference. Bevin alienated a lot of people in his own party.
And so it's almost like what works for Trump doesn't necessarily work when other Republican politicians try it out.
He might be the exception that, you know, proves the rule in that way. I don't know. He's obviously an interesting force, historically speaking, in American politics.
Let's move on to Virginia and talk about some of the specifics there. At the beginning of the year, Jeffrey, you joined me on the podcast to talk about the trio of scandals regarding the governor and attorney general, reports involving them wearing blackface or being in racist images, and then the lieutenant governor there being accused of sexual assault. And we talked then about this election in November and how much of a factor that would play in whether or not Democrats could take control of state government. After everything is said and done, can we say that that had an effect or not?
I mean, I believe Nathaniel and I have been a little skeptical that the state issues, you know, for these Democratic office holders were going to outweigh President Trump's unpopularity. And I think the results last night proved the point that at the end of the day, President Trump, feelings about him and his effect on the electoral environment were more important than the scandals involving the Democratic office holders in Virginia. I don't want to say that they didn't have any effect, because maybe things would have been even better for Democrats if they didn't have that weighing over their heads. If Ralph Northam, the governor, had been able to campaign, you know, far and wide throughout the election season as a popular governor or something, because before the scandals, he was pretty popular. And actually, there is some data that suggests that his approval rating is kind of okay right now. But nonetheless, you know, he was untarnished at that moment. We just don't know.
Now that Democrats have full control of state government there, what kind of legislation can we expect coming out of that state?
I think one of the first things you might see is a push for gun control legislation. You know, there was a terrible shooting in Virginia Beach back in May of this year. And in the aftermath of that, Governor Northam called a special session to try to pass legislation that did things like ban assault weapons, establish universal background checks, that sort of thing. And so he called this special session. They met. The Republican majorities, within an hour and a half, voted to close the special session. I think now with Democrats having majorities in both houses, you're going to see a push to pass some sort of gun control legislation. There are other things, you know, maybe raising the minimum wage that had a lot of support in the previous General Assembly session among Democrats. Another thing is the Equal Rights Amendment, which, if people don't remember, is something that's been out there for a while. It started in the 1970s as a push to sort of enfranchise gender equality in the U.S. Constitution, and it fell short of getting 38 states to support it for ratification. And right now, my understanding is that there are 37 states that have ratified it, and Virginia would be in a position to be the 38th, though there are some questions about whether the deadline to ratify has passed. So that could be like a whole court fight over that if Virginia does pass it. So that's something. And then the other thing that I think is going to be very interesting to watch.
Redistricting.
Yes, it's redistricting.
You could read your mind.
Yes, exactly. Because now, obviously, Democrats have full control. So under the current rules in Virginia, they would be in a position to draw legislative lines for congressional and state legislative districts.
They could gerrymander all they want.
They could just gerrymander away. But the thing is, it's kind of interesting here, is that in the previous General Assembly session, with overwhelming bipartisan support, a redistricting commission constitutional amendment passed through the General Assembly. Now, it has to pass unchanged, that legislation has to pass unchanged in the next General Assembly session before it can go on the ballot as a referendum in 2020 for the voters to weigh in on. And if it passes, it would then become a constitutional amendment, and Virginia would have a redistricting commission. But will Democrats go along with that now that they have full control? Will they switch it up? Unclear. So that's a real interesting thing.
Gut feeling, Jeffrey. What are they going to do?
Oh, I don't know. They passed that redistricting commission thing with such overwhelming support on both sides. It might be tough to walk back, but hey, it would also be difficult to maybe abandon the ability to draw lines. I mean, that's tough. So my feeling is that Democrats might try to wiggle out of it. I really think they might.
So this will be interesting for folks who are interested in gerrymandering and redistricting to watch. Obviously, over the past decade, Republicans had a lot more control of state governments and were able to draw the lines in 2010. And Democrats and activists have spoken out a lot about gerrymandering and said that it's wrong. So now we're going to get to see, when Democrats newly take control of state government and have the opportunity to gerrymander, do they take that opportunity, or do they stick with the, we want this nonpartisan redistricting commission to do the work, that line that they've been saying for the past decade? I think this will also give us some hints as to what will happen post-2020 with redistricting around the country. Was the Democratic line about wanting this to be a nonpartisan, quote-unquote, fair process more about being upset that Republicans were in control, or was it more about genuinely wanting a nonpartisan fair process? We are going to see. But anyway, let's expand out and let's look at Texas. So the situation there is, right, if Democrats were to pick up 9 seats in the Texas House, they would control that chamber post-2020. And we got a little taste of what that competition might look like in a special election in the 20th House District in Texas last night. So how did that shake out?
Yeah, this low-key might have been the most important outcome of the night, at least if you're going to be looking at 2020 implications.
Low-key most important. I like that.
I am hip with the kids, Galen.
All right. So what does it tell us?
Basically, so this is a kind of now swingy seat in the Houston suburbs that Romney won it by something like 30 points. Trump won it by 10. And then Ted Cruz in 2018 won it by only 3. So it's basically the picture of the kind of district that is rapidly moving to the left and the kind of place the Democrats need to flip in order to take control of the state house, like you said. But the results were not so good for Democrats. So it was a jungle primary because Texas has weird rules. And Democratic candidates got 39% of the vote combined, and Republican candidates got 61% of the vote combined. So that is a net Republican margin of 22 points, which is obviously not very good. And the race is going to proceed to a runoff because nobody got a majority. So it'll still be, there's still a chance for Democrats to win that seat. But the preliminary results just don't show the kind of shift, if you project them out statewide, that that would lead to Democrats taking control of the House.
And is that in part because Trump wasn't on the ballot and people are still interested in voting for Republicans down ballot, or what? I mean, was it turnout? What would you chalk up, Ted Cruz winning only by 3, Trump winning only by 10, and then having that kind of margin last night?
Yeah, that's a great question, Galen. And I think there are a variety of possible explanations ranging from turnout to the candidate quality. But I think maybe the most likely Occam's razor scenario is just that you know, without a Beto O'Rourke type figure on the ballot driving these, this huge Democratic enthusiasm, things kind of reverted to a bit of a partisan norm in Texas. I do tend to think that the result will be better for Democrats. So obviously the seat will be up like every other seat in Texas in 2020 when Trump is on the ballot. And I feel like Democrats will do better then, but it's a, still a big hurdle to actually flip this seat and then eight other seats like it in order to take control.
And it's also worth pointing out that 2018 was the last election for which Texas will have straight ticket voting as an option. So in 2020, voters will have to go down the line and pick the person slash partisanship that they want to vote for in each race, as opposed to, you know, just say they vote against Trump and pull the lever, and, you know, that means that there are no votes for Republicans down ballot. Obviously, Texas Republicans were keen on enacting that after how poorly Trump did relatively in the state in 2016. So let's finally land on some more obscure local races, and I'll give you kind of both the opportunity to talk about whatever you found interesting. Just indulge us in the wonky races or ballot initiatives around the state. Let's start with you, Jeffrey. What did you find interesting?
Well, I suspect Nathaniel has followed this more closely than I did, but I did notice, you know, thinking about the suburbs, the Philadelphia collar counties, a lot of them held elections yesterday for county offices, and Democrats did very well in those and took control of some that they hadn't controlled in, well, living memory in some cases. It's important to know that the suburban counties of Philadelphia used to be basically the base of the Republican Party in Pennsylvania. And so this is they've been trending Democratic for a while now. And we've seen it at the presidential level, but Republicans had still held on to a lot of a lot of local offices. But Democrats have been making gains there, and they made gains yesterday. So that, I think, is a positive indicator for Democrats when looking ahead to 2020 and thinking about Pennsylvania, you know, obviously a very important state in the Electoral College.
All right, Nathaniel, I know that you've been paying attention to all kinds of ballot initiatives and local races, so give us what you got.
Yeah, how much time do you have? So I would definitely echo Jeffrey. So I thought it was interesting that there were kind of these dress rehearsals for a couple of potentially competitive congressional races in 2020. So one of the counties that Jeffrey mentioned, whose local government switched from Republican to Democratic control, was Bucks County, which is home to one of the few Republicans who still sits in a Hillary Clinton seat. So that could suggest maybe, you know, an appetite for ousting him in 2020. You also had a special election in Missouri, House District 99, which is within Missouri's second district, which is another one of these. This is suburban St. Louis. It's a district that Republicans won in 2018, but is continuing to trend to the left, and Democrats feel that they could flip in 2020. And actually, Democrats flipped this special election, which was a bit of a surprise because it was an R plus 11 seat. So that was actually a very impressive result for them as well. And then also in the suburbs of Indianapolis, Democrats did very well in local elections in Hamilton County, which is where the Indiana 5th district is, which is another district that they kind of suburban district that they hope to flip going even deeper into suburban territory. So I'll certainly be watching those in 2020. But you mentioned the ballot and measures, and, you know, a good note to end on perhaps. So perhaps most notably, New York City passed ranked choice voting for primary and special elections, which is very interesting. So ranked
choice voting, baby.
Exactly. You know, as people probably know, it's where instead of voting for just one candidate and then the winner of the most votes wins the election, even if they didn't get a majority, ranked choice voting allows you to say, I want this candidate first, and then my second choice is this candidate, and my third choice is this other candidate. And then those votes are tabulated, and then the candidate with the fewest first place votes gets eliminated. Those votes get redistributed to their second choice, and then so on and so on until somebody has a majority. A lot of voting reformers believe that this is a better system than the kind of plurality system that most places have. Most notably, Maine passed this for most of its elections in 2018. And now New York City will have it, which I think is actually maybe even a bigger deal than people are making it out to be, because you know, obviously so many social, political, economic, media elites live in New York City. They're going to be exposed to the system for the first time. In fact, just in a couple of years, in the 2021 mayoral election, which is going to be a wide open race to succeed Bill de Blasio. And whether this system kind of is implemented smoothly and, you know, maybe yields a fairer result versus if it is seen as confusing or a failure of implementation, that's going to have huge implications for how ranked choice voting is covered. Either way, I think you're going to see a lot more mention of it in the media, in kind of the, you know, society sphere, and people are going to become much more familiar with it, and that could help it catch on in other areas.
And I'll just add there that, of course, with New York City's over 8.5 million people, it's larger than all but 11 states. And so kind of administering this in New York City will be an interesting feat. I know the Bay Area has experimented with ranked choice voting as well. And academics in San Francisco found some complicating results to this good governance push for ranked choice voting, in that it can decrease turnout amongst low experience voters, voters with lower education levels, and so on. So I am kind of, as somebody interested in political theory and political systems, as we all are, I guess, if we're listening to this politics podcast, we'll definitely be interested in how this turns out. But Nathaniel, I'll let you get to a couple more of the ballot initiatives around the country. We won't, as you mentioned, the social, economic, and media elites of New York City, we won't let them be the only word on ballot initiatives from 2019. So what else should we have been paying attention to last night?
Exactly. Let's go west, young man. Basically, you know, I think it's also been undercovered that conservatives had yesterday a lot of success in terms of ballot measures, including some surprise victories, at least to me. So, for example, in Colorado, a ballot measure that would have allowed the state to retain funds for education and transportation rather than refunding them to taxpayers, that failed, even though Colorado, I think, is a fairly liberal state. So that was a surprising victory for me for conservatives. Texas also voted overwhelmingly to ban a state income tax, or at least to put that ban in the state constitution, which is interesting because I don't think that would be on the ballot if people didn't think there was a chance that Democrats might take control of the state at some point. It's now going to be much harder for them to implement an income tax if they ever do that. And then in Arizona, the city of Tucson voted overwhelmingly not to become a sanctuary city. This ballot measure was opposed, however, on both sides, both Democrats and Republicans, so that outcome isn't too surprising. And then finally, in Washington state, there is a ballot measure to effectively legalize affirmative action, which is currently outlawed in terms of hiring and education for government and public universities. Washington takes a long time to count its results because they vote by mail, so the ballots are still arriving. But currently, that ballot measure is narrowly failing. So if that result holds, Washington would continue to not be allowed to use race, sex, things like that at all as a factor in these admissions or hiring decisions.
All right. Well, some really good information there. We covered a lot. And now that we have the 2019 election results in, final question, you guys, who's going to win the 2020 election?
The American voter, Galen.
All right. Well, hopefully, listeners, you got a lot out of that. I know I did. Thank you, Nathaniel and Jeff. I really appreciate it.
Thanks.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Nathaniel Rakich and Jeffrey Skelly are 538 Elections Analysts. My name is Galen Druk. Tony Chow is in the control room. You can get in touch by emailing us at podcasts@538.com. You can also, of course, tweet at us with questions or comments. If you're a fan of the show, leave us a rating or review in the Apple Podcast Store or tell someone about us. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you soon.